From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with Middle East historian Rashid Khalidi. He says Saddam Hussein's attempt to link his actions in Kuwait to the Palestinian issue is opportunistic. Nevertheless, Khalidi says there can be no real peace in the Middle East until the Palestinians are addressed. Also today, I talk about film music with one of the most highly regarded living film composers. Elmer Bernstein wrote the scores for about 200 films, including The Man with the Golden Arm, The Magnificent Seven, The Ten Commandments, and the new films The Grifters and The Field. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First News.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. As UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar prepares to leave for Baghdad for his meeting with Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, diplomats and analysts all over the world are speculating on his chances for success. Linda Fasulo reports from the United Nations.
The Secretary General will meet with the 12 European Community foreign ministers in Geneva before his talk with Iraqi President Saddam Hussein on Saturday. But says veteran UN diplomat Sir Brian Urquhart, this will be the first time in history that a UN leader is not able to provide a ladder that countries can use to climb out of tight corners in time of crisis. Urquhart says Perez de Cuellar has little negotiating room, and he is bound to an unusual degree by the 12 Security Council resolutions requiring Iraq to withdraw from Kuwait. Nevertheless, he says, the Secretary General's independent position will also give him room for maneuver that national leaders do not have, and his task will be difficult but not impossible. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
The White House has warned American citizens that it's dangerous to remain in Iraq and offered seats on what may be the last U.S. charter flight out of the country. Presidential spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad is trying to contact the 180 American citizens who are still believed to be in Iraq. He said they'll be asked if they want to leave the country. Fitzwater said the warning includes American journalists. Yesterday, Secretary of State James Baker said he'd asked for and received assurances that the U.S. chargé d'affaires and four other remaining diplomats would have safe passage from Iraq on Saturday. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney has recommended that President Bush implement a statute allowing military reservists to be kept on active duty for up to 2 years. That announcement today by the Pentagon further clarified a statement that Cheney had made to reporters yesterday at the White House. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
The defense secretary told reporters the statute in question not only would allow military reservists to be kept on active duty for up to 2 years, it also would give expanded authority in terms of numbers who could be activated. Under the current level of authority, the Defense Department may activate up to 200,000 reservists at any one time. The higher level of authority Cheney is recommending would allow up to 1 million reservists to be called to active duty. Cheney said yesterday, and Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams emphasized today, the Defense Department has no intention of activating that many. They say the purpose of this action is to allow the military to keep in uniform reservists who provide vital support services. Many of them are scheduled to return from the Persian Gulf by late next month. In Washington, this is Vicki O'Hara.
The Dow Industrials gained more than 28 points today to close at 2,498. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Elmer Bernstein, is one of the most highly regarded composers working in film. Although his background was in classical music, his 1955 score for The Man with the Golden Arm is considered one of the first and most influential jazz scores. His almost 200 other film scores include Some Came Running, The Ten Commandments, Walk on the Wild Side, To Kill a Mockingbird, and The Magnificent Seven. More recently, he composed the music for Ghostbusters, Airplane, and Animal House. Bernstein has written the scores for two new films, The Field, which is the new movie by Jim Sheridan and Noel Pearson, who made My Left Foot, and The Grifters, Stephen Frears' new movie about three con artists. To give you a taste, here's the opening theme to The Grifters.
Thank you.
Elmer Bernstein, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
We've just been listening to the opening credit music from one of the new films that you've written for, The Grifters. What did you want to express in the opening music for the film?
Well, quite a tale hangs thereby. The Grifters is a most unusual film, stylistically, and basically what it's about. I mean, we've all seen films about con men before, but this is a very, very special film with a very special atmosphere. Let me put it this way. I think the two critics who reviewed the film, one of them spoke of the score as wittily ironic, and another one said that it was playfully unsettling. I think both of those critics caught what I was trying to do, which really answers the question.
And I think part of the way you get at that is the odd places that you'll hear percussion, like the odd rhythms that they play and the dissonances that you bring in.
Well, yes. First of all, the thematic material itself is very odd. Its closest relation would be the kind of things that they were doing in Europe, particularly Germany in the early 30s. It brings to mind perhaps something like Three Penny Opera. It is sort of faintly decadent and faintly off-center, which sort of sets the whole atmosphere for the film itself.
The Grifters was produced by Martin Scorsese, directed by Stephen Frears. Who actually brought you on, and what did they tell you when they brought you on?
Well, you know, I've always had this theory, you know, that if you live long enough, everything comes around. Marty Scorsese, apparently, and it's a very nice thing to be able to say, although it sounds immodest, but Martin Scorsese has apparently been a fan of my music for some time and very, very well acquainted with the early films I did, and apparently particularly likes the score for a film I did in 1957, of all years, called The Sweet Smell of Success.
Oh, yeah.
And that always, it's apparently stuck in Marty's mind, and as I understand it, it was Marty who was primarily responsible for the idea of having me do the music for this film, and what's come out of it actually is I'm going to do the music for Marty's next film as a director. But in this particular film, Marty was the producer, and he couldn't have done it without Stephen Frears agreeing, but I think it was Marty's idea originally.
In a way, I think that The Grifters builds on some of your innovations from The Man with the Golden Arm, a movie that you scored in 1955, in the sense that it's a very urban music. It's a jazz-inspired music. Can we talk about 1955 for a minute?
We sure, certainly.
Man with the Golden Arm was one of the first jazz-based scores, and I think it really set a trend off. It's the story stars, the movie starred Frank Sinatra as a jazz drummer and drug addict. So obviously it made sense to use a jazz score, but what else went behind the thinking of that?
Well, if we go back to The Man with the Golden Arm, it is precisely as you said. I mean, the atmosphere was Chicago. I mean, that's where it took place. Chicago is one of the great homes of early jazz. The main character in the film wanted to be a jazz drummer. And as a matter of fact, one of the crucial scenes in the film is when he goes to an audition as a drummer and tries to get himself a job. And that's where the idea of the jazz score grew. Jazz had been used before, more sparingly in scores. I think what made The Man with the Golden Arm seem special at the time was that the use of jazz was throughout the film, and a lot of the so-called scoring pieces, the dramatic background pieces, were also jazz-based. But the feeling for using jazz stemmed from the mise-en-scène and the main character.
Let me play some of the music you wrote from The Man with the Golden Arm, and then we'll talk more about the score.
Okay. We'll be right back.
Music from The Man with the Golden Arm, composed by my guest, Elmer Bernstein. This was at the very beginning of the period when jazz ended up being used a lot for detective movies and TV shows and hard-boiled movies and TV shows.
I'm not so sure. You know, it depends on what you mean. The Man with the Golden Arm is 1955. In 1957, you get Peter Gunn, which was Henry Mancini doing a score which was basically jazz-oriented. And then in 1958, a show called Staccato went on the air with John Cassavetes, also about a detective, for which I did the score, also jazz-oriented. So, I mean, I've had very mixed feelings about with The Man with the Golden Arm. Of course, I really cherish the memory of Man with the Golden Arm because it was actually the film that, so to speak, established my career. It did something else, which I have since regretted. Studios suddenly realizing how powerful the use of popular medium can be in a film score, because that hadn't been done in quite that way before. Not quite in the way I did in Man with the Golden Arm, not so thoroughly. And the effect of it, of course, was that the record album from the score was immensely successful. And it just sort of seemed to open up the floodgates, and from then on, score after score after score was using popular music of some kind, either jazz, and then finally it went to rock and roll scores. And unfortunately, a lot of this kind of music was used for its commercial value rather than its appropriateness to the dramatic action.
So what you're objecting to, finally, is using pop music to sell a movie or to sell soundtrack recordings from the movie. You're not objecting to using popular music itself, are you?
Oh, no, surely not. No, surely not. But I just think the shoe has to fit, you know, in a dramatic point of view. Some of these decisions, I think, are made, shall we say, less artistically. Very often a certain kind of score will be put in a movie because they think it's going to sell records, whether it's good for the dramatic action or not.
Well, just about the same time that you were writing The Man with the Golden Arm, you were also writing the score for The Ten Commandments, which I think is one of the great movie religious epics. What kind of music to you seemed appropriate for a religious epic? You certainly want it to be big. And, of course, in Ten Commandments, you had to have music that was not only behind Moses, but behind God, you know? This is a tall order.
Yes, but we forgot something even more important.
What, Cecil B. DeMille?
And that's Cecil B. DeMille. <You're right. laughs> We never forget Cecil B. DeMille. Actually, DeMille was very... I mean, I found that was probably the most interesting experience in my whole life in the movie business, working with Cecil B. DeMille on that film. The music for the film was basically, the concept of the music was Wagnerian, because that's what DeMille wanted. When I say Wagnerian, DeMille's concept of the way music should work in a film was that each character should have a theme. And when the character is on the screen, that is what you use, their theme, every single time. If there are two characters on the screen, then you would then find some clever way of incorporating both of the themes. In that sense, it's very... Well, that's what I mean by a Wagnerian concept.
Do you feel that eventually the religious epics ended up with a set of musical clichés?
Well, I could answer that in one word, yes. well, necessarily so. I mean, you know, I tell you who tried to break that, as a matter of fact, was once again Marty Scorsese and The Last Temptation of Christ.
Oh, sure.
In which he
yeah.
used Peter Gabriel doing a lot of electronic music. I think, you know, it was very interesting about that. When we finished The Ten Commandments, the music of The Ten Commandments, and I'd gotten to the point of that time when I could address Mr. DeMille without saying, "Mr. DeMille, sir," and all that sort of thing. And I said to him, "Wouldn't you like to remake the picture about Christ?" He'd made a picture about Christ, Sign of the Cross, in the same period when he made the first Ten Commandments. And DeMille said to me, he was a very sort of knowledgeable person about the world and the body politic, so to speak. And DeMille said, "You know, I don't think you can make that kind of picture anymore in the atmosphere which exists in the world today." Because, you see, I think one of the problems is that kind of picture is much easier to deal with in terms of the sensibilities and sensitivities of the public by sticking with the clichés, because which have grown up in the last 100 years, like what we consider churchy music, for instance. Because I think if you don't do that, you then run the risk of somebody feeling that you're being sacrilegious. And DeMille sensed this, you know, that it would be very difficult to make that kind of a picture in this day and age. And I think, indeed, it is.
Let's listen to some of the music you wrote for the Exodus scene for the Ten Commandments. And
I can tell you a funny story about that after you listen to it.
Oh, swell. Okay. And I want to point out something obvious here, which is that it's the beginning starts off as if a shofar is blowing, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. That's pretty obvious. Here we go. This is
that's a funny story, too.
Okay. Well, we'll hear the stories after we hear the music. Okay. Music from the Exodus scene of the Ten Commandments, composed by my guest, Elmer Bernstein. Music from the Ten Commandments, composed by my guest, Elmer Bernstein. Okay, the funny stories.
Well, the first place, you know, when we realized that a shofar was going to be seen on the screen, we had to find somebody to play the shofar. Now, for those who don't know, the shofar is a very ancient instrument made out of a ram's horn. And it sounds very much like not very much, but something like a French horn, a brassy kind of sound. Anyway, where do you find people who play the shofar? Well, who play shofars, of course, rabbis, because it's still used in Jewish ceremonies. Well, one day, DeMille got, we must have had, oh, I guess 20 or 30 rabbis on the on the scoring stage. And because we wanted to get different kinds of perspectives on the sound, we had them all over the scoring stage. playing these shofars. But the funny part was it was on a Friday and we were getting dangerously close to twilight time, and we had to stop suddenly because, of course, all the rabbis have to stop working by sundown on Friday. So that was the shofar story. The story about the whole Exodus music is originally, I mean, in the Exodus, there were about 8,000 people in that scene. I don't know how many animals. There's about 8,000 people. And they move quite slowly, necessarily, as 8,000 people would, carrying their belongings with them. So I wrote a sort of very slow, anthem-like processional. DeMille heard it, and he hated it. And I said, well, what was wrong with that? I mean, it looks like the picture to me. He says, that's the trouble. It looks like the picture. And the picture is too slow. He said, now I have to tell you that these 8,000 Hebrews in this scene were being played by 8,000 members of the Egyptian army, which is already pretty funny. And DeMille said, no, I want something with spirit. He said, something like Onward Christian Soldiers. And so finally we have that accounts for the way the Exodus sounds now. But it always seemed funny to me because it was terrifically ecumenical, because eventually what you have is 8,000 Egyptians playing Hebrews marching off to music like Onward Christian Soldiers.
That's terrific. Let's take a short break, and then we'll get back to a conversation with Elmer Bernstein about film music. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Film composer Elmer Bernstein is my guest. Let's get to another score that you wrote. This is such a great theme. I'm thinking of the theme from The Magnificent Seven, which was a Western epic based loosely on the Seven Samurai. Now, you wrote the theme for this. It was also a big pop hit. It was in the top 40, a version conducted by Al Ciola and
his
orchestra.
Yes, Al Ciola did a sort of guitar arrangement of it.
Yeah, so was that good for you? Did you wish you had the hit?
No, I'm basically very unselfish that way. I'm funny about that. I don't like to see the attitudes of the music changed, and in that sense, the Al Ciola thing was very, very different. That bothered me a little bit. No, it didn't bother me that he had a hit because, I mean, obviously it was very good for me. The best thing that ever happened from a purely economic point of view that happened with the Magnificent Seven is the theme was leased by a certain tobacco company.
We could say the name. People remember the Marlboro commercials
commercial. And that's terribly funny. When I perform this piece at concerts, especially in Europe where they still use those commercials, where they can still do those kinds of cigarette commercials, I can hear the whisper go through the audience. They hear it, and of course they know it better as the Marlboro thing.
Let's hear the theme that you wrote for The Magnificent Seven. Gosh, I love that music.
Thank you.
At what point do you see the footage? Do you like to see rushes from a movie before you even start thinking about what you're going
to
write?
Well, the great directors always have you involved right from the beginning. I mean, in the case, we're going back in The Man with the Golden Arm, the Man with the Golden Arm, I was at the studio at the very first time the cast sat down around a table and read from the script the play. Marty Scorsese, for instance, for whom I'm doing a film, is shooting a film in Florida. We had a chat on the phone the other night. Now, Marty, who's, I think, one of the geniuses of our field, Marty wants me to come down to Florida, for instance, to see some stuff. You know, while it's a work in progress, great directors generally will do this, and they generally not only want the composer there, but really enjoy the composer's input.
What do you do if a film is re-edited and suddenly the music isn't going to work because the length of the scenes has been changed?
You know how to ask the right questions. I tell you, you know what you do? You suffer a lot, a great deal. An edit can be very, very painful because it's not just a question of cutting a bar here, cutting a bar there. Hopefully you get a chance to rewrite it. And then re-record it. Now, I mean, all sorts of odd things happen. I mean, going back to The Grifters again, I enjoyed very much working with Stephen Frears during the creative period. He came up to my studio in London, and we played things for him on electronic devices, synthesizers, so he could hear what the score was going to be like. And the recording was absolutely delightful and thrilling and exciting. Interestingly enough, when Stephen ran the picture a couple of times, he decided that he really wanted to change the character, really of the film was what he was playing with, and took the score as it existed, didn't change any of the music, or the music's all there, except he used some of the music more than was originally intended, and moved all the music around in the picture, which not in the way we'd originally designed it. I thought to myself, my goodness, this isn't, never going to work. Well, and I didn't see what he had done. And then the picture started to be shown, and people would call me and say, gee, the music was really effective in that film. I think to myself, my goodness, you know, what's really happened here? I dare say, here's a case where the composer and the director would have done very, very different kinds of things with the music. Now, I don't know why Stephen felt the way he did, but it is possible that ultimately we wound up ultimately with very different views of the film. But interestingly enough, he could still use all the same music. It's just in different places.
Well, Elmer Bernstein, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your music.
Thank you.
Composer Elmer Bernstein, in addition to composing the score for The Grifters, he's also done the music for another new film, The Field, which is set in Ireland. Let's listen to some of it. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In his press conference after his meeting with James Baker, Iraq's Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz accused the U.S. of having a double standard in the Middle East. It threatens war if Iraq doesn't comply with the UN Security Council resolution, but it's never demanded that Israel comply with Security Council resolutions concerning the Palestinians. Coming up, we look at the relationship between Iraq and the Palestinians with Rashid Khalidi, Associate Director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Chicago. Also this weekend, the public television series Dance in America showcases the work of choreographer Peter Martins. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, debate is underway on whether or not to authorize President Bush to go to war against Iraq. As NPR's Mara Liasson reports, the Senate has begun debate on a resolution concerning the use of force in the Persian Gulf.
The Senate Democratic leadership, led by Majority Leader George Mitchell, presented a resolution today that supports giving sanctions and diplomacy more time to work. The resolution asserts that when and if war is necessary, only Congress can authorize it. Supporters of the president in the Senate, who are working on their own resolution that will authorize the use of force, urge their colleagues not to send Saddam Hussein the message that the American government is divided, and they said it would be wrong to deprive the president of a credible military threat. The vote in the Senate is expected to be close. Today, President Bush met with a bipartisan group of senators to lobby for their support. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Hundreds of U.N. employees and their families are leaving the Middle East in advance of a January 15th deadline for Iraq to get out of Kuwait or face the possibility of military action. At least 12 countries, including the United States, say that they are pulling their diplomats out of Iraq after the failure of talks yesterday between Secretary of State Baker and the Iraqi foreign minister. More than 100 scientists and researchers from some of the nation's top universities today called on the president to give sanctions more time before launching an attack against Iraq. Andy Bowers of member station WBUR in Boston has this report.
It includes Nobel laureates and other professors from Harvard, MIT, Brandeis, and most other Boston area universities. At a news conference today, they said a Middle East war would be devastating. They also said sanctions will be particularly effective against an underdeveloped country like Iraq, which imports almost all its technology from the West. And the scientists called on the U.S. government to make energy conservation an urgent national priority. MIT molecular biology professor Jonathan King organized the group.
This is not a peace group. We are not a group of disarmament activists. Many of these people, mechanical engineers, have never signed a petition, nuclear weapons.
Yeah. One physicist said because scientists are involved in the development of many high-tech weapons, they have a particular responsibility to oppose their use unless absolutely necessary. For National Public Radio, this is Andy Bowers in Boston.
In Washington, the Pentagon has now denied that six Iraqi helicopters defected earlier this week to Saudi Arabia. Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams says that the defection story apparently began with an alert from one U.S. soldier along the Saudi-Kuwait border who reported hearing helicopters cross the border. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 28 points to close at 2,498.76. Volume 124 million shares. Advancing issues led declines nearly 3-2. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Now that the meeting between James Baker and Tariq Aziz has ended in failure, the French are pursuing a diplomatic solution that would call for an international peace conference on the Middle East after Iraq's withdrawal from Kuwait. The conference would address Israel and the Palestinians. The U.S. opposes this linkage. But peace in the Middle East requires addressing the Palestinians, according to Rashid Khalidi, Associate Director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Chicago. Khalidi has written extensively on modern Arab history and the rise of Palestinian nationalism. At a press conference after the Aziz-Baker meeting, the Iraqi foreign minister didn't discuss Kuwait, but he did discuss the necessity of resolving the Palestinian question. I asked Khalidi if he thought Iraq was being opportunistic in dwelling on the Palestinians, and wouldn't linkage reward Iraq's aggression?
Well, very clearly both sides are posturing in public in a way that plays to their selected audiences. The Iraqis are trying to make it appear that they're doing everything they're doing for the sacred cause of Palestine. It takes a really wild stretch of the imagination to believe that, and I don't think most people in the Arab world do, but what the Iraqis are trying to do is to say this is not simply a case of invasion, annexation, occupation, and so on and so forth. It is, in fact, linked to these causes that most people in the Arab world believe have some merit. Similarly, the United States is trying to deny that there is a connection between security issues relating to the Gulf and security issues relating to the Arab-Israeli conflict, trying to deny a variety of things that are probably true on the face of them, and trying to focus things as narrowly as possible on the issue of Kuwait. I think that where the issue of linkage comes up, the important point is if there should be a settlement in the Arab-Israeli conflict, this is a question that should be decided on its merits. And if everybody is so terribly concerned about not making it appear that there's a reward for aggression, then deal with these issues sequentially. I mean, there is within diplomatic parlance and within the imagination of mankind certainly sufficient devices so that it does not necessarily, there is no overt obvious linkage, but such that it is possible for the world to address another glaring problem after or in sequence with dealing with the problem of Kuwait. People often say, how can we deal with the Arab-Israeli conflict? We must deal with the most recent aggression. What a lot of people in the Arab world say is, well, why deal with the one that's only with the one that's recent? What about the ones that have been around for a long time? And if this is something that's a problem for the United States, and I can see how it might be, you don't want overt linkage, very well. Say there's no linkage. We'll deal with Kuwait, and then very quietly say, and some others at some definite stage in the future, we're going to deal with this other thing. The reason that you should do this is that they are linked. I mean, you can't talk about Iraq's nuclear capacity or Iraq as a strategic threat without talking about Israel. In fact, that's the only thing most people who talk about it in this country have any interest in. I have to say, most people who worry about Iraq and the United States are not really terribly worried about Iran or Turkey. Many of them perhaps are worried about Saudi Arabia, but most of them are worried about Israel. Well, since there is an interrelation between Iraq and Israel, since Iraq is a part of the Arab-Israeli conflict one way or another, then very clearly, in real terms, there is some form of linkage.
You would like to see a Middle East peace conference specifically address the UN Security Council Resolution 242 from 1967?
And a number of other UN Security Council resolutions. There is a stack of UN Security Council resolutions on the Arab-Israeli conflict a lot higher than the stack relating to the Iraq of Kuwait. There are resolutions relating to Israel's annexation of Jerusalem, resolutions relating to the Golan Heights, resolutions relating to South Lebanon, passed by an international consensus, including the United States, the Soviet Union, and all the other permanent members, with exactly the same force in international law as the 12 resolutions that Secretary Baker talked about in his press conference, which have lain gathering dust since 1967 or 1969 or 1978 or whenever. I would like to see all of these resolutions taken as the basis for a serious effort to solve the Arab-Israeli conflict. I think it's a gross hypocrisy, grotesque, and really something quite grotesque of the United States to launch the current effort on the basis of UN Security Council resolutions when the United States seems not to be lifting a finger to implement other resolutions that it voted for, in some cases it wrote, drafted, sponsored, and which have lain ignored and in some cases flouted by Israel or by other Middle East parties for decades in some cases.
Let's get to the resolution of 1967, Resolution 242. What did that say?
Well, it's always been boiled down to the formula of land for peace. That's the way it's traditionally been interpreted. It talks about an Israeli withdrawal from territories occupied in the 1967 conflict. Note the term the United Nations uses. It uses occupied. Contrary to the assertions of some people, as far as international law is concerned, Israel is in occupation of those territories. It then calls for a just peace. It calls for relations between the Arab countries and Israel. It calls for, in other words, a real normalization of relations between Israel and its neighbors, of the right of all states to live in peace within secure and recognized boundaries, and so on and so forth, as the sort of quid pro quo for this Israeli withdrawal from these territories that it occupied in 1967. That's the gist of 242.
I think a question about 242 is how would a peace be enforced if Israel gave up the occupied territories? Israel lives in constant fear that neighboring Arab states wouldn't respect the statehood of Israel.
Well, remember that Arab states would have to sign a treaty with the state of Israel, would have to recognize the state of Israel, would have to do the kinds of things that Egypt has done, exchange ambassadors and open up aerial links and all that sort of thing. Moreover, in 1991, we have a whole lot of examples of how you normalize abnormal situations. The way in which the Cold War has finally wound down in Europe and the kind of agreements on reducing forces and guaranteeing security, which have finally been worked out between Europeans, Americans, and Soviets after many, many decades of wrangling, I think maybe provide an avenue or a clue as to what can be done in the Arab-Israeli case. It's not only, I would argue, that the various disputes have to be resolved and that there has to be peace and an end to occupation and so on and so forth. I think there also has to, very clearly has to be, movement towards control of weapons, movement towards control especially of strategic weapons in the region on a mutually agreed basis, and that's going to require a lot of haggling. But I think security has to be a part of a settlement and a security agreement such that the kinds of fears, which I have to point out not only Israel, but most of its neighbors have with good reason, are addressed. I mean, you're talking about a situation where Israel, because of Jewish history, is in fear of possible consequences of war, and because of Israel's own specific history, has had an experience of many wars. Similarly, the Arab world perceives Israel as a potentially dangerous to it. And nowadays, Israelis are worrying about the possibility of bombardment of Tel Aviv or Jerusalem. Beirut, Damascus, Cairo, Amman, Tunis, and Baghdad have all been bombed by Israel. So both sides have lots of fears, and there are security concerns on both sides. And any settlement would have to do more than just rearrange boundaries. It would have to also address very, very explicitly these kinds of fears in the kinds of ways in which the Europeans have finally put to rest similar concerns that have plagued them for since World War II.
Rashid Khalidi is my guest. He's Associate Director of the University of Chicago's Center of Middle Eastern Studies. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Rashid Khalidi is my guest. He's an associate professor of Middle Eastern history at the University of Chicago. I'm going to ask you really straightforwardly here. You're part Palestinian, and I'm wondering if, because of your own background, you are seeing the Iraq question as relating to the Palestinian question more than others might.
Well, I think that anybody who has read the flood of this media and other output since the crisis began will have noticed the number of times, the hundreds and thousands of times, that the issue of Iraq is related to the issue of Israeli security. I don't think I or any Palestinian American invented that link. In other words, Israelis are concerned about Iraq. Iraqis are concerned about Israel. Israel bombed Iraq. Iraq threatened Israel. You know, one could go on and on and on. I don't believe that that's an invention of the Iraqis or the Israelis or me. Moreover, the United States chose to take this issue to the Security Council and chose to raise this into a sort of a sacred crusade on the basis of the sanctity of international law. It just happens that international law is indivisible and that Security Council resolutions are equally valid or should be equally valid, and that there is a whole avalanche of Security Council resolutions voted for by every American administration since the 60s, relating to the Arab-Israeli conflict. So in those two, at least as far as those two elements are concerned, linkage is something that is a fact of life, whether we like it or not, whether we accept it or not, whether we want to bury our heads in the sand or not.
You agree that Saddam Hussein didn't invade Kuwait with the ultimate goal of helping the Palestinians. What are his ulterior motives in trying, in bringing the Palestinian question into the negotiations?
I would agree. I don't think that that was the motivation for Iraq, whatever the Iraqi government says. I don't think that that is credible. I think that the motivations have to do with a variety of things. One was a serious miscalculation of the American response to an invasion of Kuwait. That miscalculation was based on a reading of the American position before August 2nd, which was perhaps understandable, but wrong. Secondly, there was very clearly a desire to punish Kuwait and a desire to obtain resources to extract Iraq from its crushing economic crisis. There are probably a number of other factors, and most of them, I would argue, have to do with Iraqi national security and Iraq's immediate foreign policy objectives rather than the Arab-Israeli conflict or the Palestine question.
But what does Saddam Hussein have to gain by trying to make a connection between the Palestinians and his invasion of Kuwait?
It's one of the few things that he can presume or pretend justifies the invasion of Kuwait. The invasion of Kuwait, on the face of it, is indefensible. It's indefensible in Arab terms, and it's indefensible in terms of international law. Nobody in the Arab world that I know of outside of Iraq recognizes the annexation of Kuwait, including countries that are supportive of Iraq in its confrontation with the United States. So the Iraqis have a very weak case in international law and before Arab public opinion, to the extent to which it can be restricted to the single issue of Kuwait, to the extent to which they can muddy the waters and to some extent extent they've succeeded in doing this, by talking about their having done this for the sacred cause of Palestine and so on, to the extent to which they can point up what is unquestionably hypocrisy on the part of the United States in its refusal to budge on certain Arab-Israeli issues or to see to the implementation of Security Council resolutions that deal with Israel, while it shows alacrity in implementing Security Council resolutions that deal with Iraq. To the extent to which the Iraqis can do that, they are playing, if not a winning card, at least a viable card in terms of Arab public opinion.
What effects do you think the conflict in the Gulf is having on Arab unity?
Well, the conflict of the Gulf has revealed the divisions in the Arab world. At the same time, I would warn people who are jumping up and down in glee at the prospect of the Arabs yet again divided and cannot restrain their pleasure at this prospect, that there's a very deep level at which in the Arab world at which there is unanimity. I would argue there are very few people in the Arab world who want war, and I would argue that there's the reluctance to contemplate a war and the fear of its results is something that could well be the basis for a very strong, if not Arab unity, at least trend within the Arab world. And that this is the case in countries like Egypt and Syria and Morocco, which have troops in Saudi Arabia, just as it's the case in countries like Yemen and Jordan and Sudan and Libya and Algeria, which are much more skeptical about the American presence. So there is no Arab unity, and the Arab world is deeply divided. Certainly the Arab governments are deeply divided, and Arab public opinion shows a number of different outlooks and trends. But on a couple of issues, there's very, very strong consensus, and one of them is that settlement should not be achieved by force, but should be achieved peacefully. And I don't think there'll be any support for a war when war comes.
Among Arabs?
In the Arab world, yeah.
Do you think that even Arab countries who are American allies wouldn't fight if there was actually a war? That they might break away?
They might have to, but I don't think there'll be any support for it, and I don't think that you're going to see a lot of officers and men fighting the Iraqi army with any enthusiasm on the part, particularly of the Egyptian and Syrian armies. These are armies that have considered the Iraqi army their ally over many wars. These are, in the case of the Egyptians, these are people who have helped Iraq against Iran in the Gulf War very recently. And the idea of helping the United States to smash an Arab army is not going to go down well in the officer corps of the Arab countries that are participating, even if their leaderships order them to participate. I don't think that it's going to be something that people will do with any pleasure, and I don't think it's going to play well in Damascus and Cairo.
Let me ask you, we're hearing about FBI attempts to find Arab Americans and to investigate whether they're part of any possible Iraqi-related terrorism. What do you know about that? And I wonder if you've been contacted at all or have friends or colleagues who have?
Many people in the Arab American community have been contacted. And I think that this really boils down to an unfounded assumption that Arab Americans could conceivably engage in such things. And because they have to know better, it really amounts to harassment. There's no reason that the agencies of the United States government do not know that this is simply unfounded and unjustifiable as an assumption. If they don't know it, then it's a disgrace. And whatever the intentions behind it, that certainly is the way it's being perceived in the Arab American community.
You know of people who've been contacted?
Yes, I do know of Arab Americans who've been contacted just in the last couple of days.
Let me ask you a question that you might see as kind of flip, but I'm just kind of curious about the answer. I don't know if you heard it or not, but recently on All Things Considered, Harry Shearer did a very funny sketch about how President Bush is constantly mispronouncing Saddam Hussein's first name.
Mm-hmm. Calling I didn't hear it.
Oh, okay. Well, he keeps calling him Saddam. Mm-hmm. And so Shearer, you know, it was very funny about how this is just like another way to alienate and irritate the head of Iraq. How is his name pronounced? Do you know?
Saddam Hussein is the way his name is pronounced.
Is anybody taking offense at George Bush's constant mispronunciation?
I don't know that anybody's taking offense at it. It's a sign of ignorance that after 5 months the president can't pronounce it correctly. It's a sign of the... I take it as a sign that nobody who knows enough Arabic to tell him that he's mispronouncing it is close enough to him to talk to him. I mean, it's pretty clear that this is a government operating without the benefit of any expertise on the Middle East, or they wouldn't have done many of the things they've done in the past 5 months. And every report I've read, whether in the New York Times or stuff I've heard on National Public Radio, indicates that the people innocent, are innocent of any knowledge of or experience in the Arab world or the Middle East. We do not have a lot of expert advice up there, as far as I can tell. It shows from the results, but it's also been reported, and it's, everybody I know says the same thing. People in the government and outside the government who are experts all seem not to have been consulted. And if that's the case, as I think it is, it's symptomatic, and it's symbolized by the fact the president can't pronounce the name of this person that he's been demonizing for the past 5.5 months.
Do you have any hope left for peace?
Not very much, unfortunately. I hope that it will still be possible to stop a war. I hope that I hope the Iraqis will see reason and make whatever concessions are necessary. I hope the United States will see reason and show whatever flexibility is necessary. And I hope whatever mediators get involved can exercise some leverage in Washington and Baghdad. But I don't think that that's very likely, unfortunately.
Rashid Khalidi, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Rashid Khalidi is Associate Director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Chicago. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, the Senate has begun its debate on the Gulf.
That's right, and the House is expected to begin its debate fairly soon, if not tonight, then tomorrow. The members of Congress are struggling with their attempt to take a position either in opposition or in support of the president. We'll have reports on diplomacy on other fronts, including the United Nations, how the soldiers feel about what has happened, the view of the war from Warrenton. It's a small town in Virginia not too far from here. And we'll be taking a look at Lithuania.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz is a big fan of the New York City Ballet. He has a preview of the latest PBS Dance in America telecast, which features members of the ballet. It's called Ballerinas, Dances by Peter Martins. It airs on most PBS stations this weekend.
Peter Martins, who's now ballet master-in-chief of the New York City Ballet, was a great dancer, but is a controversial and erratic choreographer. Two of his 5 ballets on the latest Dance in America telecast are far from his best. They're predictable, romantic duets to Beethoven and Sibelius that are vehicles for Kieran Nichols and veteran ballerina Patricia McBride. More interesting is the Barber Violin Concerto, which Martins made in the spirit of mutual respect for City Ballet principal dancers Merrill Ashley and Adam Luders and modern dancers Kate Johnson and David Parsons. The dance begins with a double pas de deux for each pair. Ashley and Parsons then team up in the romantic slow movement. Then in the brisk finale, Johnson is like a tiny gnat who buzzes around Luders as he keeps trying to shake her off. It seems to me that Martins is better at irony than at sentiment. One of his best pieces is to music he commissioned from composer Michael Torkey. It's called Ecstatic Orange. It's fun to watch Heather Watts and Jacques Soto go through the seductive contortions of the purple movement. The best reason to watch this program is the last piece, Sophisticated Lady. Martins choreographed it in 1988 for the City Ballet's American Music Festival, and he says it's a tribute to the glamour girl side of Balanchine's greatest ballerina, Suzanne Farrell. She agreed to perform it only if Martins himself came out of retirement to dance it with her. It begins with Farrell being courted by a line of young male dancers, including Martins' own son, Nilus. She rejects them all in favor of Martins. In their pas de deux to Duke Ellington's Solitude, Martins turns Farrell's extraordinary deep backbends into airy lifts. Sophisticated Lady is the epitome of glamour, ballroom dancing raised to sublimity by these great artists. After the premiere, Martins added a terrific section to Don't Get Around Much Anymore. On the telecast, the new section is omitted. They danced it once again at Farrell's emotionally charged farewell performance in November 1989. This TV program was taped in October 1989, and the publicity for it is misleading. It's billed as Farrell's final performance. On the program, Martins talks about dancing with Farrell one last time. But it's Farrell's farewell only to television, and though it was the last ballet that Farrell and Martins danced together, they danced it more than once, and this was not the last time they danced it. PBS evidently wants to mythologize this telecast. It's disturbing that an organization that wants our trust should choose to bend the truth in this way.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews are produced by Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we look at how France and Britain redrew the map of the Middle East after World War I and how that relates to today's conflict in the Gulf. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Not Without My Daughter, a movie based on a true story of an American woman trapped in Iran. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.